The conference is now being recorded.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is Mary Kay Wimsett. I'm with the statewide office, and we have a training today on adoption review committees. This was a topic that was requested by many of you, and really appreciate all of the questions that we got that I received last week. It is very interesting to see or to read about how the practices vary statewide. And we are recording this training, so I would encourage you if you have attorneys or volunteer supervisors that are not able to listen to the call today, that you encourage them to listen to it. I'll send out an email whenever we are able to post it on our website. We will also, if we have time at the end, we will take questions. I have you guys all on mute so that we can get through this without the interruptions, but we will take it off mute at the end and have time for questions. I would ask, I would beg, please do not start hanging up because it's very, very difficult to get through the questions because we have so many. If everyone starts hanging up, the beeps are just, and we have a lot of folks on this call. So if you have to run to court or just leave your phone down and have someone in your office hang it up for you, you know, by 1:15 or so, we should definitely be done. But please, please, please do not all start hanging up at the end during the question and answer period because it's very rude to our presenters and it's almost impossible then to hear them when they're trying to answer the questions. So with that, I'm going to introduce our speakers today. I'm really excited that both of these professionals have agreed to do this. They've put in a lot of work preparing for this, and we're very lucky to have them here today. The first is someone who's, of course, near and dear to me since she's in my circuit, but I can't think of anyone more qualified to do this other than, of course, Michelle, who's her co-presenter, but is Kim Johnson. And Kim Johnson is a native of South Florida and graduated from Villanova School of Law, who left the practice of law for the position of adoption program manager with the Partnership for Strong Families in 2008. In this capacity, she is responsible for oversight of the adoptions department at the lead agency over foster care and adoption in 13 counties in North Central Florida. And she serves as the chair of the Adoption Review Committee for Circuits 3 and 8. Kim was a presenter at the FCC conference in 2011 on post-adoption services in light of the Nubia Barahona tragedy. She has also received an Adoption Excellence Award from the Department of Health and Human Services Children's Bureau in the area of media and public awareness of adoption from foster care. And Kim has adopted a teen from foster care herself. And then we also have, from a different part of the state, Michelle. And Michelle, I'm going to have you say your last name so I don't mispronounce it. We've been communicating.
That's okay. That's okay, and I meant to send it to you. It's Whiteside.
Michelle Whiteside. And Michelle is a South Carolina native and graduate of Clemson University. She has worked in child welfare for 11 years as a caseworker, court case manager, Wendy's Wonderful Kids recruiter, and director of services. Michelle has worked at Family Support Services since 2008, and she currently oversees the Adoption Department and sits on the Adoption Applicant Review Committee for Circuit 4. Michelle received the 2014 Lighting the Way Award from the Florida Coalition for Children and was named a 2014 Angel in Adoption from the Congressional Coalition on Adoption Institute. So with that, I'm going to hand it over to our speakers, and just to give you guys an idea of the format, what we're going to do, we've identified several topics that we're going to kind of take you through the path of a case through the Adoption Review Committee process. And Kim and Michelle are going to take turns, covering those topics, and then they'll jump in when they have something that, differs. So, and Michelle has a case that she's going to refer to kind of to give you guys an example of some of the things that she's going to be that they consider as part of the adoption review process. And I know that Kim also will jump in with other examples as we go through the issues. So, and I don't know, ladies, which one of you wanted to start, but what we're going to do is start with at the very beginning, because it was interesting that some of you call these ARCs and some of you call them AARC. So they're the same thing. So that's an easy one that even I can handle that one. But it's so it, just so you know, and for purposes of your volunteers, the ARC and as well as the AARC are the exact same thing. I'm not sure why the CBCs have chosen to designate them differently, but that's where we are. And Kim and Michelle, do one of you want to, I'm not sure which one of you want to start.
Go ahead, Kim.
Okay. All right. So we'll begin, I guess, with the first question that we had received that is a good starting place anyway as to what law governs adoption review committees. Basically, adoption review committees are provided for by Florida Administrative Code, Section 65C, 16.0059. They're provided to allow an additional tier of review for cases in which the counselor and supervisor are recommending denial or situations that present challenging issues. That section of Administrative Code does provide four areas that must be referred to the committee, but then there are also discretionary basis in any challenging case where the adoptions workers themselves are having some questions, concerns, or do want some additional attention devoted for further review can be brought.
Correct.
And I think, and I think want
to add. And I was going to say, just in Duval County, we do tend to overstaff cases just to be safe, because I don't think there's a, it tells you what you must staff, but then it leaves room for if you're kind of on the fence of whether we should or shouldn't staff it, we'll just go ahead and staff it just to be safe.
And to be a little bit more detailed, the four areas that must be referred are issues that involve health concerns, verified abuse history that are short of disqualifying felonies, but are verified abuse records, and also abuse histories that involve some indicators. Those all fall into the second prong. Additionally, criminal history, if there's a person who has had a conviction that falls under Florida Statutes 39.0138, Section 3 within the last 5 years, those must be brought to the ARC. And likewise, any family that has had a foster care license and has had some licensing concerns in the past, those are the other group that must be brought.
Okay, and the next question that we received was, are the circuits required to have a standing ARC committee? And just to let you know, our circuit here in Duval and Nassau, we do refer to them as AARCs. It's just the Adoption Applicant Review Committee, and I think the reason that they differ among the circuits is because it differs depending on what part of the code you're looking at. Sometimes they include applicants, sometimes they don't. So if you hear me say AARC, it is the same thing. But regarding the requirement to have a standing AARC committee, yes, it is referenced in the Florida Administrative Code that there must be a committee that is available to case managers and case management organizations to review any and all applicants who have either the four areas that Kim referenced with regards to having to have an AARC or at least a group that can be a different set of eyes to look at challenging issues that a case manager or supervisor may just need assistance with to look at and get input as to whether a denial or an approval should be issued.
Okay. And then I guess I will cover what front-end work is recommended. In our circuits, we recommend that the case manager that's preparing the case to come to ARC reviews the entire history, particularly with detailed attention to those areas of concern that are bringing the case to ARC, as well as to really get a thorough familiarity with the child and the family, since sometimes certain concerns may be mitigated or may at least have relevance to understand the child's standpoint, the child's characteristics, and the family's other supports, strengths, and so on. Our case managers prepare a written cover letter that summarizes what the concerns are that are bringing the matter to ARC, as well as any other input that may be valuable for the committee to have as an overview before we dive into reviewing the items that we review. What we do review are the adoption home study, the child study for the child psychological evaluation, those aspects of the criminal history or whatever the history or of concern is, any of that that we have a privilege to view, we view. And then we also ask for it to be brought to the committee, anything that has been done in the past that would have potentially mitigated the concern that is present in the history. If the person has undergone treatments or services of any type, those are very helpful for us to know up front. And lastly, the other step of preparation is, of course, inviting participants, because we value input from any and all resources that we can have so that we can try to make our best informed decision. So we encourage participation by anyone on the case who is able to contribute valuable information, whether it's from another agency or even in best case scenario, if we have cases where it's a FAHES history, for example, we would love to be able to hear from the investigator if that person's still around, and so on, just so we can try to get as clear a picture as we can of the concerns as well as what everyone brings to the table to help us understand how that might currently be a risk to the child or not be a risk to the child. Michelle.
And pretty much goes for our circuit as well. The more information, the better. I think if in doubt, we have them send it, because the more we can get to give us a broad, clearer picture of the family, the better information that we have and the better decisions we can make. It also helps when we are issuing, if it's a case that we ultimately issue a denial, the more information that we have to support the reason for our denial helps in drafting the denial letter, which gets sent to the family. And I think we've got some questions toward the end that kind of touch on the denial piece. But the next question that we had from those that are on the call was, when there is a concurrent goal of adoption, how does the GAL get the CBC to begin the exploring of adoptive placements? We're very fortunate in Duval and, well, Duval County and in Circuit 4, because our local dependency judge, Judge Gooding, requires that all of our cases have concurrent goals, and he is very pro-adoption. So at any time, it looks like a child or children are not going to be able to be successfully reunified with their parents, he is asking the adoption question. So we typically don't have a difficulty in getting our case managers to look at adoptive placements or prospective adoptive placements. And another fortunate thing that we have here in Duval County is that we have pulled the adoption recruitment efforts for children that don't have an identified adoptive home. We pulled those in-house, so we took that responsibility from our four case management organizations in 2011. So we have three recruiters that work directly for FSS, and their sole job description is to search for adoptive families for children who do not have an identified family. So that helps in getting case managers to start talking about adoption, because they know that they have assistance with looking for adoptive homes. So typically, and another thing that the court does is that we have adoption status hearings, where any child whose goal is adoption and we're post-TPR, the judge hears those cases about every 2 weeks to get information about the efforts that are being put into finding an adoptive family. So whether they want to or not, a lot of times our caseworkers are, they have to be proactive when it comes to adoption. I don't know if it's any different in your area, Ken.
Well, we do quite often have concurrent goals of adoption, but I thought, Mary Kay, you had said that we could start a dialogue at some point, so this is probably a helpful area for our circuits if I do take a bit of a trail into a dialogue or conversation. It has been a challenge in our circuit at times, or our circuits at times, when we have late-coming relatives. We do make best efforts to do diligent searches for relatives during processes, as well as to encourage the bio families and anyone who's involved in the case to be in communication with us about other prospects for adoptive placements. But nonetheless, at times we do struggle with family members coming forward late in the game, and that can delay permanency, as you know. So I was just curious if when you were mentioning that your judge is really good about kind of eliciting information that helps to identify those early on and explore those early on, What is done in your area to explore those to a level at which they're not likely to come up again down the road as somebody who is applying to adopt and who is potentially going to delay permanency for a child if they do endure the whole process?
Okay, I'm going to try and take us off mute, okay? So,
presentation mode is now disabled.
Okay, so, good, we can actually hear. So, if Kim has asked just to repeat, to hear from you guys as to what is happening in your circuits in terms of concurrent planning. And I know there are a bunch of you on the call, so some of you not from the North Central Florida, if you could chime in and let us know what is happening in your circuit in this regard.
I'm sorry, this is Kimber Stavridge from the Fourth Circuit. We are trying to access the call through Skype, and I could not understand the last question. I think it was directed for the Fourth Circuit.
Well, I was asking for someone other than the fourth or the eighth, actually. So Kim had asked for some feedback from other parts of the state. So, you know, the Panhandle, South Florida, Tampa, Orlando, you know, anywhere but North Central Florida, asked to, you know, what efforts the judiciary is making in terms of concurrent planning and the guardian ad litem and, you know, or how it's you know, what the process is for concurrent planning in your circuits in terms of the Adoption Review Committee.
Thank you for clarifying that.
Hi, you guys.
I'm here.
This is Judy Burke from the 13th, Tampa. And I think the reason you're not hearing anything, or at least I can speak for us, is that obviously it varies from judge to judge. We have several different divisions, including an adoption devoted division. This is a problem. This is an ongoing problem. And even when they finally are, all rights are terminated and they get into the adoption devoted division, we are still experiencing cases where we have a child with a foster parent for the past 2 years of their lives. It's an adoptive placement. And all of a sudden, we discover relatives had not been explored prior to coming into our division. And we have to put the brakes on everything and start exploring these relatives to the point where we're fostering visits between the child and these relatives because potentially on initial background screens, there's nothing that would keep us from doing that. So it varies. Is the answer to your question, at least here and at least in my experience. Some cases we have relatives right up front adequately processed and basically crossed off the list or their potential is developed. And in other cases, it seems to fall through the cracks.
And this is Michelle, and I'll jump in real quick because we had a recent and I just forwarded this to Kim so that she could take a look at it. We had a recent situation because it happens to us all the time. You have a child that's been in a home, whether it's a relative, a non-relative, a foster. We move in the direction of adoption by that current placement, and then all of a sudden, whether it's right before TPR or after TPR, a relative or someone who has a significant relationship with the child kind of pops up and says, I'm interested in adoption. In adopting the child, and the way that the current administrative code is written is that if it is a relative that expresses interest in adopting the child, we have to allow them the opportunity to be assessed through a home study. Not so much of a huge deal when everyone is in our circuit or in our county, but becomes a huge deal when this relative happens to be out of county or, heaven forbid, in Georgia, because we know that the ICPC process is going to take a very long time. One good thing that we learned a couple weeks ago, it just hasn't, and I haven't announced it to our folks in Duval and Nassau County yet because it's still not written into the code. It's something that we're expecting to be written into the code. So if I'm challenged on it, it. I don't have anything to reference just yet. But one of the revisions to the code that we're very excited about is that in these situations where you are heading in one direction of adoption by a particular person and then a relative pops up after TPR, we will be able to tell that relative or non-relative, whoever it is that is applying, that in order for us to complete a home study, the relative or non-relative has to present their case, so to speak, to the dependency judge, and we have to be ordered to complete that home study as long as we have a signed, I believe it's a signed memorandum of agreement. So we're finally going to have something that we can kind of use as a drop-dead date, so to speak, so that if we already have this one piece of paper signed, we can stop recruiting, we can stop taking applications, which we haven't had in the past. It's been very loose in the way that the admin code has been written. So we recently had a case where I presented it to Tallahassee, explained this is one of those that's happening. Can we please be relieved because this relative that's inquiring is out of state and it's going to delay permanency? And she wrote back and said, yes, based on the fact that the child has been in the current home for so long, there's limited relationship with this relative. You can go forward with telling them, sorry, we are not going to start the ICPC process. If you are truly interested in adopting the child, you can come to court, present your case to the judge, and if the judge orders us to do a home study, we will. But otherwise, no, we're not.
Mary Kay and Michelle, this is Camille in the 19th. Can I just follow up on that, please?
Yeah.
Hi, this is Camille in the 19th. Michelle, you raise a very good point. We have a case right now, and if you can just speak to, as the code is written now, there is a section above the other relative priority that addresses best interest. So you mentioned that there will be upcoming changes and amendments to the relative priority, but can you speak as the code is written now and the language of best interest, if you have a situation where the child is in a foster placement or there is an anticipated adoptive foster placement and a relative is coming now into the picture, does a home study or must a home study be done by the department, or can a decision regarding that it's not in the best interest of the child, that relative be pursued as the code is written now?
I think it depends on where you look in the code, because there's two, and I'll see, because I meant to grab my code before I got on the call. Let me see if my phone will stretch. Because in the code, since the code likes to say one thing in one section and something completely different in another section, it does, depending on where you're looking, it will say, let's see. Let me see if I can flip to it quickly.
Page three is where the priorities are, Michelle. You probably know that.
I'm trying to get to my. I've highlighted so many important things that it's now basically all highlighted, and now I can't find them. But in one paragraph, it speaks specifically to situations where you were moving forward with adoption by the foster parent, and then a relative states that they want to adopt. And in those specific cases, you can look at attachment, kinship,
and permanence
for the child. Thank you, Kim. Yes, occasionally a child whose parents' rights have been terminated, we're moving forward with foster care adoption, has a relative that indicates an interest. The following factors must be considered in making a decision that represents the best interest of the child. And that's where we have to look at attachment, kinship, and permanence. And then we are able to make a decision as to whether we want to move forward with continuing to look at this relative or say that based on attachment, kinship, and permanence, we think that it's in the child's best interest to be adopted by the current foster parent. But then in another part of the code, it says that if a relative, and I think that's under the first part of 65C-16.002, under the other relative priority, it says that other relatives may wish to be considered as an adoptive placement for the child. If such a relative is identified and requests consideration of adoptive placement, the application of the relative must be evaluated to determine suitability through an adoption home study. So it says two completely different things depending on where you're looking at the code. So basically what we tend to do in Circuit 4 is figure out where we need to look so that we can, which one is going to give us more wiggle room, so to speak, so that we can make the best interest decision for the child without delaying permanency. And just if we end up denying a relative based on one section or the other, we are just very, very careful to cite the part of the code that we are referring to when we send out the denial, because it does. It says two completely different things when it comes to relatives who express interest in adoption after you've kind of made plans for adoption by another parent.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Let's go ahead and move on to the next topic, just because it's already 12:30 and I want to make sure you guys get to everything. We can always come back to this if there are more questions. And I'm going to go ahead and put it back on mute, but I'll take it back off when we're going to open it back up.
I guess, Michelle, I'll
be the next mode patient. Is now enabled.
Shall I resume with the questions, Michelle?
Sure, yes.
All right. So back on track, can the adoption case manager give the family an adoption application before TPR? Absolutely. That's kind of a short answer, but the sooner they could be working on it, the better for everyone's purposes.
And then the next one was, how does an adoption case manager discuss a failed home study with a family, and how do they explain that they are unlikely to pass the AARC review process? We encourage in Circuit 4 the caseworker to have a very frank and honest conversation with the family and go into detail regarding the reason for the denial. We found that, you know, if you try to skirt around the reason, it makes for a prolonged process. So we tell them to, you know, if we're denying because we have concern for a drug abuse, to let them know that that's why we are denying. We will tend to not discuss the outcome of an AARC until we actually have it, because depending on who ends up coming to the AARC, we may approve something that the caseworker thought would be a denial, or we may end up denying something that the worker thought would be an approval. So we try to have them hold off on the exact reason for denial until we actually know that we are going to deny. We have in the past tried to dissuade families from appealing if we knew that it was going to be just a delay of permanency and they ultimately were most likely not going to win anyway. We have since stopped doing that just because of cases in the past where they just kind of came back to bite us. So.
Okay. And disqualifying offenses. Basically, the disqualifying offenses mirror those that are disqualifiers for placements under Florida Statutes 39.0138. There are the types of offenses that disqualify a person forever, consisting of felony convictions that fall within certain categories. The categories are child abuse, abandonment, or neglect. These have to be felony convictions in those areas. Domestic violence, child pornography, or other felonies in which a child was the victim of the offense, or homicide, sexual battery, or other felony involving violence other than felony assault or felony battery with adult victim. And then there are five-year disqualifiers, which are felony convictions of assault, battery, or drug-related offenses, and those fall under subsection 3 of the same section.
And then the next one is, when is the AARC required? I think we've pretty much already covered that, is whenever, basically what Kim had just reviewed, whenever there are felony convictions or the abuse history with some indicators or verified reports.
Can AGL send a case directly to the AARC? That's not how the process works in our area. We have referrals that are received by the adoption staff and sent to the ARC. Now, we definitely would want a guardian ad litem, if they had concerns for a case and felt that it should be subject to that review, to bring it to the attention of the adoption staff so that it could be referred. But it's not typically directly referred by guardian ad litem in our area.
And then who is allowed to attend? In Circuit 4, we encourage any stakeholder that's assigned to the case, whether it's the guardian ad litem, volunteer, case coordinator, attorney, and that would be the GAL attorney, therapist, anyone really that has knowledge of the case and that can speak to the needs of the child or what they've observed in the caregiver's home, we encourage them to attend. In Duval County, we typically don't have the applicants themselves appear. They can submit a written statement that may give the committee a better picture of their family. We have had applicants attend in the past, but what we found is that sometimes you can be swayed because they're able to present very, very well, and it can take your attention off of the fact that they may have a very horrendous history that we're looking at, and yet they present well, and you know, you tend to feel for them when they're sitting at the table. So to try to keep it a little more objective, we don't typically have the applicants come to the staffing.
And that is one distinction in our area, that we do encourage the applicants to come. It's just been our perspective that we can get the total picture a little better when we also are able to hear from them personally, and that also helps us, or personally we feel that it does, when it comes to further levels of review. If they are denied, we also have available information that we've received personally from them about their current circumstances. So it's just our preference typically to encourage them to come in person, and if they have an attorney, to bring their representation. All right. Next question was, is it required that the guardian ad litem be allowed to attend? I don't know that it would be a requirement, but in our opinion, it's best practice. So guardian ad litems are definitely encouraged to attend in our circuits.
And what type of notice is required to be sent to the participants? We have a standing every 2-week schedule for AARC, so our caseworkers and most of our guardian ad litems know that every other Thursday there will be AARC. So referrals are due to FSS by noon the day before, and then we try to get the schedule out by 3 o'clock that day, and we do send it primarily through mail. And most of the time, just because it can be difficult to keep up with who all of the participants that need to be invited are, when FSS sends the schedule, we do remind the caseworkers to notify any stakeholders that need to be present that the schedule has been sent, what time it's going to be, and where the location is, so that everyone is informed of the date and time. We have had some situations where we might have a court conflict and the guardian ad litem or the therapist will send just an emailed note as to their concerns or lack of concerns to me so that I can have that information, and then we just present it on their behalf at the staffing.
What recommendations or services do we see most often? In our circuits, it's most often that we see assessments recommended, usually in the area of either domestic violence assessments, substance abuse assessments, or mental health assessments, depending on what the nature of the concerns were that brought the matter to ARC.
The next question was, any unusual recommendations you've seen? I think Kim stated in their area they didn't really have anything that was too unusual, and I could only think of one, and it was we discovered that the husband who was applying, he and his wife were applying to adopt, he was not legally divorced from his first wife before marrying his second wife, so we had to recommend that he actually remarry his current wife, and then it got a little hairy after that because she ended up saying no and didn't remarry him, and I think we're still battling that one, but that was just one of those off-the-wall kind of recommendations that we had to make.
What are the legal requirements for approving or denying a home study? And basically that falls under all of 65C 16.005, the whole section, basically.
The next question was, what standards govern the AARC decision-making process? And I think from Kim and I both, there are no concrete standards except for the items that fall under automatically disqualifying an applicant. Anything else really can come down to what the committee as a whole recommends. We try to have the same members or the same standing members for the AARC staffing so that we can try to ensure some consistency in our decision making.
How long does the AARC have to issue their recommendation? And that is 10 working days.
How long does the family have to appeal the decision? If a family is denied, they have 21 days from the receipt of their denial letter to request a hearing. There are requirements that fall under Section 120.56 of Florida statutes and Rule 28-106.201 that go into detail as to the time frames and what the prospective adoptive parents have to do in order to request a fair hearing.
All right. Does anyone explain to the family that because an automatic disqualifier or other extreme facts, substance abuse history, they're going to lose at the administrative level, and by appealing, they're just delaying permanency for the child? We would definitely try to have everyone who's involved with the case from the outset be informing any prospective adoptive placement of those sorts of concerns, especially the significant ones that we do know are likely to result in a denial. I don't know how consistently it's always done, but it's something that we are trying to work on and make sure that that communication is there, especially because we have seen how these things can become delays later on. Also, because the question talks about automatic disqualifiers, I don't know if it's the same in everyone's areas, but what we've historically done for the automatic disqualifiers is not bring to ARC, but rather have DCF write the denial through region, because if it's an automatic disqualifier, there's not anything that in our discretion at ARC we can do to say it's okay and going to be approved or approvable. So for automatic disqualifiers in particular, it is a little bit more brief of a process, but there still is going to be that potential due process right there that can add those delays.
Do adoption case managers ever discuss visitation with families who have failed home studies in hopes of encouraging them not to appeal or deny the process? Yes, we do encourage our case managers to speak with these families and try to help them make the best possible decision for the child rather than the best possible decision for themselves. We do try to intervene and explain to prospective adoptive families that we want to do what's in the best interest of our children, which is sometimes not in the best interest of the families that are applying.
In the process for appealing a denial, in the due process letters received by the family as a result of the denial, they're provided contact information so that they can know how to appeal to the Office of Regional Counsel. And then Michelle has added to our notes that that letter that the family does write to request the hearing must meet the requirements of Florida Statute Section 120.56 and either Rule 28-106.201 or Rule 28-106.301 of Florida Administrative Code, or else it can be dismissed.
And I'm actually going to take the next question, which is, what is the guardian ad litem's role in terms of that appeal process? Well, you know, of course, if the family has questions about the letter, then you should encourage them to follow the directions in a timely manner, you know, so that they're not excluded for time frame issues, and then, of course, for them to consult with an attorney if they wish to. The guardian ad litem can also potentially, you know, participate in the administrative hearing to some regard, but it's tricky because you're not technically a party. But I know that guardians have been witnesses before in some of those hearings. So if you have a case where the guardian ad litem is supportive of the position of the family or the whoever is appealing the ARC decision, then you need to staff that with your supervising attorney and staff that with you know, your attorney at the state office who covers your circuit. just so everyone can get on the same page about how to proceed. Okay, that's all I have to say on that.
After the administrative process is resolved, what is the next step? And it said discuss both paths the case could take. If the applicant wins their appeal, they may then file an adoption petition with the dependency court and ask for what's known as a BY hearing. And BY just stands for, is just the child's initials for the first case that happened this way. So basically what they would do is ask for a trial and have the court make the determination as to which family is the most appropriate family to adopt the child. And this is when I think Kim had better information, because I'm not real sure what their next option is if their denial is upheld.
Well, it's interesting because it must be handled different ways in different places, because in my experience, when we had one where when the denial is actually upheld, we've had one who's actually, I believe, gone on to appeal to the District Court of Appeals, if I understand correctly, but it's a new case and it's just happening, so to be frank, it's my first experience with it. But even when they win the appeal, I think we've seen it go different ways as well, because we've had one recently where the administrative court approved the home study, overruling our denial of it, and ordered that it come back to our ARC for a match. And so rather than the dependency court being the one who was weighing in on the decision, it was returned back to our adoption review committee to render that decision.
Some other questions that didn't really go along with ARC, but they were questions that were sent in related to subsidy, and if a family could still get subsidy if they ended up adopting over the objection of the AARC committee. And as long as all other requirements for subsidy are met, yes, those families do still get subsidy.
And then how can a family be approved for permanent guardianship but not pass an adoption home study? And I think that's a very good question, because that's actually kind of an area that I don't like to see go that way. If there's been a concern that it warrants attention by the Adoption Review Committee, I would prefer a process where we really thoroughly address it with the Adoption Review Committee and try to, as best we can, remedy any needs that are present and have the home be strong enough for adoption, because I find it a challenge when for a placement to be deemed sufficient for permanent guardianship but not for adoption, because in either case our eyes are no longer on the placement, and in fact under certain facts there can be a little less support there if it's permanent guardianship versus adoption, at least less secure supports there. So I think that's a really good question, and I don't know that I have an outright answer for that one.
Yeah, it's another one of those that we see happen a lot, that what we are trying to do is just educate our caseworkers, because the most frustrating thing is that adoption is so tail end, and what we're seeing most of the time, what we're seeing come before us for an AARC has to do with arrest history or abuse history, and it was there when the child was placed with the family. It most of the time it didn't, you know, all of this history was not accumulated in the time that the child has been in the home. So we're trying to teach and train our caseworkers that when you get a case from the department, just because the child is placed there and you have a concur letter, don't just take it at the face value of the concur letter. Look at those FDLEs that come with it. Look for trends, because like Kim was saying, the things that are automatic disqualifiers or 5-year disqualifiers have to do with felony level offenses. So the concur letter could be generated. Someone might have an arrest. They've been arrested for drug abuse charges or violent crimes. Started out as a felony, but ultimately ended up as a misdemeanor, or you know, there wasn't enough evidence, and it was ultimately dropped. So that's what they're looking at when they're processing a concur or non-concur letter. We look at it with more scrutiny when we get to adoption, because we know we're about to lose jurisdiction of this case, and we want to make sure that these children are in the safest environment possible. So when you start to look at FDLEs, you can have many situations where you have a concur letter, but you've got somebody that was consistently arrested for the same thing for 5 years straight. So we're able to look at that and say, we need, you know, what's the likelihood that this person, once we step out of their lives, is going to be adopted again? So we're really just trying to put more training up front to dig into these FDLEs. And if you find an arrest, see if there's a corresponding abuse history, and not wait until the last minute to actually dig in and look specifically at charges and try to compare them to each other, because it is frustrating.
I guess I'll take the last one. Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, sorry. And then the last question we had was resources available to help explain the AARC or the ARC process to the family. I don't think either one of us really have any readily available resources other than just trying to get our caseworkers to explain as best they can to the families. They would, of course, be great to have so that we can hand them out and have families know what we're looking at and what their options for appeal are should they be denied. But as to my knowledge, and I think Ken's knowledge, we don't actually have any written resources that we can get our hands on to hand out to families.
Agreed.
And then that was all the questions that we had ahead of time.
Yeah, sorry, I was talking and forgotten. I hadn't taken my phone off mute. We have a few more minutes so we can answer questions. I did want to just touch on one thing that I think is important that Kim mentioned, but I wanted to make sure you guys are all aware in terms of the subsidy issue, the administrative code, because I know we're seeing more and more cases with interventions that are being filed by attorneys and not necessarily agencies. But the administrative code requires that adoption subsidy be applied for via an agency. So if you have a family that is working with an attorney, especially an attorney that may be a very experienced family law attorney but is not experienced in adoptions, you need to make sure that they are aware of that. And they can contact the adoption case manager in their circuit, and that person, I know Kim in our circuit is very helpful about giving the attorneys, you know, kind of a path for what they need to do to apply. But, and you cannot wait until after the adoption finalizes to do that subsidy application. That's something they need to be doing, you know, the minute that the case has taken that path towards adoption, they need to be working on subsidy. It is a complicated process, and it takes a long time. So it is, and if you wait until after the adoption, it's a real mess. And I don't know. I mean, Kim would probably know better than I, and Michelle would know better than I would. But my understanding is it's typically not possible if you've waited until after finalization and you have not worked with an agency at any point to get subsidy in place. I know there was one case, Kim, you were talking about, but did you guys were you able to get subsidy in that one case?
So far we've been fortunate. I wanted to make one comment. There is an exception. Well, there are actually two exceptions. If a child is a recipient of SSI or has been previously adopted, those are two exceptions to there needing to be a licensed child placing agency that a child's permanently committed to in order for us to approve subsidy. So just so you know, there's that one exception there so that the field knows that out there. And so far, we have been very successful at making a lot of scrambles and getting subsidy done before a case will finalize, although we have had at least one where they did have to postpone the finalization a bit because we don't have the ability to approve subsidy after a case is finalized. We must deny it. Now, if we deny it, there is an appeals process where the family can go through a 120 administrative appeals hearing and get it ordered that the subsidy would be approved, but it's much less work for the family, and why would you want to put them through that? So, you know, definitely we very, very much value those attorneys that contact us early when they're even remotely considering doing a filing on behalf of a private, you know, family who's adopting privately, so that we can work together and collaborate on getting everything together nice and timely so that the family can be approved before they finalize.
And I'm going to go ahead and take you guys off mute. can ask
to know.
Presentation mode is now disabled.
No one, someone's put us on hold. That's lovely. Okay, go ahead, though, if you have questions. I know I got one email already, so please jump in.
I do have a question. This is Christina Clemenson from the Sixth Circuit. And in our circuit, ECA has decided that they, our CDC, has have the authority to basically override the decision of the ART committee. That there is, you know, basically what happens is there's no ARC report, and the decision is sent on to the higher ups at the CDC, and they have made decision to override the. In that case, it was the denial, and require more steps. To get the relative approved. And I wonder what authority there is for that, or if you think there is any authority for such a thing.
Well, I'll say that in administrative code, in our same section we've been referring to, 16.05, section 9, at subsection A5B, it does provide that decisions denying applications should be provided in writing to the applicant and must include the reason for the denial and the judicial option for review of the denial per the Administrative Procedures Act. So we do try to explain our reasons for denial quite clearly. Others may do that differently or perhaps not as thoroughly. And we've not had a situation where the CBC has or would overrule it because our CBC is very involved in the ARC process. With myself being from the CBC, we have two CBC members who are on the committee. So we work quite well in collaboration with all of the team.
Yeah, and our CBC is part of the ARC committee, and the DCF is there also. So. That's not the problem.
When the ARC has denied and then the CDC wants to ultimately approve them, or when they've been approved and the CDC higher ups want to deny them, is it one more than the other that you see?
It's been where. So far, I think it's where the ARC wishes to deny, and the CBC says, no, there needs to be, you know, we need to try to remedy the problems that you've identified.
It's the CBC leadership. The executive director wants to send it back for more services to be put in place before it, so it doesn't hit the appeal process. They send it back to the ARC committee to get more, put more services in place, essentially. Is right, Christina?
Yeah, that was their reasoning. I mean, the CDC, I mean, the ARC had reasons that I don't think are curable, but that was the reason that the higher-ups at the CDC didn't allow the denial to go forward.
I had a question from the Fifth Circuit.
Yeah, and before you go, can I just remind everyone, we don't have you on mute. A bunch of you are talking away, and we can hear you, and it makes it very difficult for all the rest of us to hear. So please put your phone on mute, because now we've got it open so we can hear everything. So sorry, go ahead, Fifth Circuit.
I was wondering if you know what the legal basis is to prevent a child from being placed out of foster care into a pre-adoptive home prior to the approval of subsidy. I understood what you said about prior to finalization of an adoption, you want to have the subsidy approved, but would that hold up placement?
No. I mean, Michelle, please feel free to interject if I've misunderstood, but an approved home study would be the basis for the placement. Now, if you're just talking about making the placement legal, subsidy does not necessarily have to be approved. You just have to have an approved placement home study.
Right, and that's the same here. We try to do them at the same time only because we want to make sure, especially if it's a child that has very significant needs, we want to make sure that once they are permanently placed in that home, that finances aren't going to be an issue. So when we can, we like to have subsidy approved at the same time or a couple of days before the child is actually placed, but it doesn't have to be. Subsidy just needs to be in place before finalization.
So there's no statute, administrative code, provision, or rule that you're aware of that would prevent that?
Not that I'm aware of, no.
Might just be a local policy then?
Could be.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Any other questions? Okay, well, thank you so much, Michelle and Kim. Really appreciate it. And we will be posting this on the website in a week or two. Bye, everyone.
Thank you.